And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us. It's the Monday edition of It's Your Turn here on WISR. Midsummer day, mid-July day. We're exactly halfway through the month of July. How did that happen? Halfway through July already, July 15th. Well, it looks like midsummer, feels like midsummer. This is the nicest stretch of weather that we've had all spring and all summer. This is the fourth straight day where it's been just fabulous. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, today. So you can't beat that, especially given our track record over the past couple of summers. Enjoy it while we have it, huh? Open talk of the first portion of the program today. Our phone number is 283-2525. 283-2525. Going to be talking on the next segment of the program about something that happened not during the summertime, but over Christmas time, a so-called Christmas truce that happened during World War One. Somebody asked me about this a couple of weeks ago, and they thought it was a World War II thing. No, it was World War One, actually, more than 100 years ago. Early in World War One, the Christmas truce. We'll be talking with historian David Pietruja. Get the full story, the accurate story of what became known as the Christmas truce in the trenches in World War One. But that's a little bit later on the program. Open talk to begin with. 283-2525 is our number. We had a call last week from somebody wondering about e-cigarettes. You know, it's they came out, I don't know, a couple of 4 or 5 years ago. E-cigarettes. The most popular brand of electronic cigarettes is Juul, J-U-L-E. You may not be familiar with it, but if there are any teenagers in your family, I'm sure they are, as it's become very popular with teens. There's some concern over whether or not these e-cigarettes are harmful. They have nicotine. I mean, there's no tobacco in them, but there's nicotine. And most of the medical folks that I've seen interviewed and talked to say they're concerned about them. They do not think they're harmless in any way. We really don't know anything about the long-term effects because they haven't been around that long. Over the weekend, the CEO of the company that manufactures Juul, and they're cranking this stuff out as fast as they can, 24/7, Juul, said, I saw the interview on TV over the weekend, said, we never intended this for teenagers. This is for adults. And I'm watching TV and I sat up in my chair and I said, how can these people lie? This is a bald-faced lie. I mean, their commercials were aimed at teenagers. They were, believe me, their commercials were not aimed at adults. Now they've changed. They're pulling some of the flavors that would appeal to kids and teens. And their latest TV commercials are aimed more at adults. But for this guy to say, you know, right into the camera, well, gosh, we never intended it for them. We're disappointed. It's just, it's a lie. Straight, bald-faced lie. So I guess they get away with it. I don't know. He did it. It's just nuts. Somebody has to stand up to these people and say, listen, you're lying. I'll take no excuse for it. You're lying. Well, anyway, we had a caller last week, a couple of callers. I think we were talking about these e-cigarettes and their increased popularity. So that's the latest development on Juule, J-U-L-E. I see some people with these electronic cigarettes here and there. I don't see them very often, but I have seen them around, you know, here and there. I have no idea how much they cost. You know, I see them advertised in convenience stores and so on, anywhere where you buy cigarettes. Juul. Oh, we never intended this for teens. Baloney. We had another fatal motorcycle accident over this past weekend. Tragically, folks, you really have to be careful and watch out for motorcyclists. Every once in a while, you'll see a sign. I've seen them along the roadway. Watch out for motorcyclists. That is absolutely true. And especially during the warm weather season, that's when folks who have motorcycles are out and about. You know, they don't drive them in the wintertime. Too cold. Road conditions, not good. But you just have to be alert. So many of these accidents occur when people in other vehicles did not see motorcycles coming. You know? Some motorcycles have their headlights on. I do not have a motorcycle. I don't know whether the newer models automatically have the the so-called driving lights like all the newer cars have. Newer cars these days, when you turn it on, you know, the headlights come on. They're not quite as bright in most models as they are when you actually have the headlights on, but they're driving lights. They enable people to see your oncoming vehicle more readily than they would otherwise. I don't know whether newer model motorcycles already, you know, also have these automatic headlights. I don't know, but for goodness sakes, if you're out in your car, your SUV, your pickup truck, this time of year, do be careful for motorcyclists. Look out for motorcyclists. They're out enjoying the roadway, and we just have a lot of accidents. Tragically, another fatal one this past Saturday, Route 8 South at McElmont Road. So be careful. Watch out for the men and women on the motorcycles. Open Talk at 283-2525 is the number, 283-2525. I once had a motorcycle a long time ago, and it was a pretty small one by today's standards. It wasn't a moped, but it was a small motorcycle. It was fun for a while. Had it for a few years. 283-2525, Open Talk. Let's get to the people here today. Hi, caller. This is Dave Malarkey. Go right ahead. It's your turn. You're on the air.
Hey, Dave.
Yes.
Hi. The cigarette that you're mentioning is not J-U-L-E, but J-U-U-L. So I make that correction.
I spelled it wrong. I bet it is pronounced Juul, right?
It is Juul, pronounced Juul, but it's J-U-U-L. And Sean Hannity spells it out when he advertises it on his radio program, but it's J-U-U-L.
Are you familiar with it at all? Have you, you know?
No, I don't use it. I don't smoke at all.
Mm. Did you see the interview with the CEO of the company that manufactures that over the weekend?
No, I did.
He said, we never intended this for teens. What a joke. Of course they did. I mean, look at their TV commercials. It's terrible. Listen, thanks for the correction. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
So long. Juul. J-U-U-L. I was spelling it wrong. I'm not familiar with the product. I've never used it and never will. But J-U-U-L. Juul. I'm disappointed that so many teens are using this. We never intended this for teens. Oh, yeah. What a bozo. 283-2525 is the number. 283-2525. Open Talk on the program today. Hey, it's a big week in Saxonburg. This is the biggest week of the year in Saxonburg. Without question, I think, right? It's the week of the Saxonburg Firemen's Carnival. goes back 100 years or so, something like that. Long tradition. And the carnival starts tomorrow. They're having a community day today from 5 to 8 p.m. this evening. All kinds of stuff happening on Main Street in Saxonburg with activities for the kids, activities for everybody. But tomorrow the actual carnival begins. They've got the pet parade, which is a much bigger deal than you might think in Saxonburg. It's a lot of fun. That's tomorrow night, and then they have the big firemen's parade on Thursday night. Always on Thursday for the firemen's parade. And the firemen's carnival continues through Saturday. So Saxonburg, a hopping place to be this week, starting this evening and then running all week long. Nice to have you with us on the It's Your Turn program today. One of our sponsors is Going Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping center. They're located in the Shockey Mini Storage Complex, which is right behind King's and Villa Grande restaurants on Newcastle Road here in Butler. I trust Going Postal Butler. I've utilized their service. They package your items for shipping. It's very convenient. You don't have to worry about finding the right size box or the bubble wrap or the special mailing tape or the address labels or any of that stuff. They do it for you. Take the items to Going Postal Butler, and that's it. You can ship it any way you want. U.S. Postal Service, UPS, FedEx, that's your choice. But they'll package your things up and you ship them out. They also offer some other services at Going Postal Butler. Copying, scanning, faxing. You can rent a temporary mailbox there, too, if you need that. And they have an official notary if you need to get something notarized before it goes out in a shipment. Going Postal Butler in the Shockey Mini Storage Complex, right behind King's and Villa Grande restaurants on the Newcastle Road here in Butler. Going Postal Butler is open Monday through Friday. You can call them at 724-841-0044. Your friendly neighborhood shipping center, that's Going Postal Butler. Open talk on this first portion of the program today. Phone number is 283-2525, 283-2525. Saw a portion of a PBS special last night on Channel 13. Peter, Paul, and Mary at the Newport Folk Festival, 1963, 64, 65. This would have been fairly early in the career of Peter, Paul, and Mary. They only put the trio together in 1962. But they appeared all 3 years, 63, 64, 65, at the Newport Folk Festival. And this was a special that was put together just last year, and it was all black and white film, never seen before on television, about Peter, Paul, and Mary. It was a fascinating. I only saw about the last 45 minutes. I missed the beginning of it. I didn't know it was on, actually. But boy, am I ever glad that I watched it. And I had interviews, too, with the two surviving members of that trio, Noel Paul Stuckey and Peter Yarrow. Mary Travers, of course, died. And I didn't realize until I heard Peter and Noel Paul talking about it. She died 10 years ago in 2009. Yeah. But these two guys are still alive. They're Peter Yarrow in particular looked a little frail. If you saw the show last night, looked a little frail. But they're getting up in years, both of them. Still able to sing and play the guitar. In fact, during one of the pledge breaks, they did a portion of a song. Great to hear them again. What a treasure, huh? Peter, Paul, and Mary. Anybody see that show last night? Old footage, black and white footage. There was one song where Peter Yarrow was doing a song with Joan Baez, a very, very young Joan Baez. I thought when I saw that clip that she must have been, you know, she looked like she's about 17. I actually looked it up after the program. She was 22, but a very young-looking 22, and doing a duet with Peter Yarrow. Really good stuff. PBS, public broadcasting. Thank goodness we have public broadcasting, huh? I mean, when you compare this stuff, I don't watch everything that's on Channel 13, and some of the stuff does not appeal to me, but it's quality television. Quality television as opposed to some of the other stuff that you see when you click through the channel. I can't believe that it's on. There's something called Dr. Pimple Popper. It's on, I don't know, it's at the Learning Channel or Discovery or one of those channels. My 600-pound life. It's on all the time. You don't have to watch this stuff. You can see it if you're going through your channel guide. You know, stuff that's on. Incredible. Naked and Afraid. What? That's been on, I think, for a couple of years on Discovery Channel. Wow. So we got that stuff. If you don't care to watch it, you don't have to. I certainly don't. But thank goodness for PBS, huh? Public Broadcasting. Certainly was a great show last night. Peter, Paul, and Mary. At times they are a-changing. To watch them sing Blowin' in the Wind. And the intensity when they were singing that song back in the early and mid-1960s. Really a pleasure to watch. In fact, one of the two of them, I'm not sure whether it was Noel Paul or Noel Paul Stuckey or Peter Yarrow, said that it was kind of surprising to him to watch this black and white footage from back in the early and mid-60s and seeing the intensity with which they sang and the reaction of the crowd. It was pretty great. I was fortunate to see Peter, Paul, and I saw them live 3 times. Saw them in Pittsburgh a couple of times. Saw them in New York State. Saw them at Chautauqua one summer. Long, long ago. They were formed in the early 1960s. They disbanded in 1970. They had had a modicum of success during the so-called folk era in the early and mid-60s when it was really at its peak. But they disbanded and kind of figured, you know, that was the end of that. And then they reunited in the late 70s, 78, 79, and did a couple of concerts, and the people loved them. And then they recorded several more albums after that, and they were even bigger after they reunited than they were originally. Peter, Paul, and Mary. And they were together and performing occasionally live up until Mary Travers' illness. She suffered from leukemia and died, as I mentioned, 10 years ago. But they are a treasure. And if you didn't grow up in that era. I was not a big Peter, Paul, and Mary fan in their initial organization. I knew of them in the mid-60s, but when they reunited in the late 70s, that's when I really began to appreciate just how good they were. Peter, Paul, and Mary. You're listening to It's Your Turn here on WISR. It is the Monday edition, the mid-July and actually mid-summer edition, if you think about it, where, you know, summer, June, July, August, we're midway through July, midway through the summer. Yikes, yikes. Okay, let's get back to the people here today, 283-2525. Hi, caller, this is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn. You're on the air.
Hi, Dave. I had something happen to me yesterday. You wouldn't believe.
What happened?
I went down to get gas down at that new gas station on Hanson Avenue.
Yeah, the Speedway, I think it is. Yeah.
Yeah, boy, that's a real education in itself. You get you get the public broadcasting, you get the news and weather. Do you get gas in there yet?
I have not. What do you mean? Is it coming out of the audio, the public address, while you're getting gas?
Yeah, and then they got 20 ways to pay if you, you know, if you want to pay. I just went in and paid with cash, but I don't know. That's a real education. I never went through one of those yet.
Yeah, it's a nice place. I stopped in to grab a paper one time, nice and clean.
I got a question. How do birds hop like they hop? They don't use their toes. They just hop around. Like a crow, they'll like waddle, you know, but these birds, they just, how do they do that?
Got me. I'm not a bird expert. I have no idea.
We had an eagle in our yard the other day.
Was it hopping?
No, he was sitting up in the trees, and the crows were just bothering him. The crows don't get along with they can outfly an eagle. You know, crows are a heck of a flyers.
Well, if it was a battle between a crow and an eagle, I'd take the eagle, to be honest with you.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I would too, but, you know, I was running a survey on these crashes, these intersections, or especially that one down there, Kelly Chevrolet. They're coming up through there from coming north. They're going probably 60. You know, they don't slow down. They think they can run that red light or run that intersection, and it turns. That's a very deceiving intersection.
We certainly had a tragedy there yesterday. Yes. Listen, I got to move along. Good to talk to you, though. Always is.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks. 283-2525 is our number. Caller, thanks for waiting. I appreciate your patience. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
Yes. I'm curious, after reading an article in the weekend paper concerning the drug bust of the L.A. guys that were working out of Walker Avenue location.
Yes, uh-huh.
And it said part of the article told about they got $35,000 that happened to be part of what was on them. Well, where does, like, $35,000 go to?
You mean
when
it's seized by police? That becomes government property.
I mean, is it used perhaps for addiction therapy? You know, does it go toward maybe people that need that type of help?
I think it might be used toward further, you know, use by the police and the drug task force for further enforcement. But I don't know for sure. I do know that it becomes government property, just like a vehicle that might be seized, you know, in a drug bust that has hidden compartments for heroin and stuff like that.
Would it stay within the location, say that particular amount in Butler County?
Yes,
yes. Does it get shipped off somewhere?
Not, to the best of my knowledge, it stays here locally, but it's seized property. I mean, it certainly doesn't go back to the drug dealers, I assure you of that.
Yeah. Okay, I hope it's put to good use, because it's a couple times a week you see not that large amount, but constantly money in the hundreds, maybe thousands of dollars being picked up from these people.
Yeah, sometimes $5,000-$10,000, but that was a pretty big chunk in that particular case.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Good question. Thank you, my friend. Thanks.
Bye.
283-2525. It's open talk here on the Monday edition of It's Your Turn. Hi, caller. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
I just wanted to talk about the old type cigarettes, or of course back then they smoked the pipe, but there is no nicotine. I'm just plain tobacco. My grandfather had them in a 10 box of cigarettes.
Now wait a minute, you're telling me that there was a time when cigarettes did not have any nicotine?
Yep, way back when.
I never heard about that. I thought that was you know, it was in tobacco.
Tobacco cigarettes. Yeah. My grandfather had that type. I don't know where he bought them out, but they were in a tin box. You know, like a cigarette, but a little bit bigger. You know.
Well, I know that cigarettes have come packaged different ways in, you know, over the decades, but I never heard of tobacco cigarettes that did not have nicotine in. That's news to me.
Well, I'm not quite sure about it, but they didn't, they didn't have at the top end of the cigarette, you know, the part that you smoke from. And I noticed there wasn't just plain tobacco. But I guess they can. I don't know if they sell it in a pouch yet, like the chew, or.
Well, yeah, that's still sold, yeah, for people who want to do it. It's
yeah
dangerous stuff.
Yeah, it is. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Sure, thanks. So long. I never heard of, I thought nicotine was naturally occurring in tobacco. It's not added, is it? I mean, in, you know, regular cigarettes, I don't think so, but I don't have a tremendous amount of expertise there. It is added, obviously, in the Juul, J-U-U-L, electronic cigarettes, because there's no tobacco in those. But they do add the nicotine, because that's the addictive ingredient in tobacco. You know, whether you're chewing tobacco or smoking tobacco or whatever, it's the nicotine that's the addictive factor, the addictive ingredient, and very, very addictive. You know, some medical experts say it's as addictive as heroin, nicotine. But I don't know. I never heard of any tobacco cigarettes that did not have nicotine. Well, we are approaching the end of our time for Open Talk. We'll have more, of course, later in the week. We always do. But we want to take a break right now, and we're going to be talking about the Christmas truce on the next segment of the program, so I hope you can stay tuned for that. And I do hope that you are able to be with us tomorrow. We will have a very special program tomorrow from CBS Radio. Of course, here at WISR, we're an affiliate of CBS Radio, so we get our national news. And we're doing a special on the upcoming 50th anniversary of man's landing on the moon. Can it be 50 years since Neil Armstrong stepped off the ladder of the lunar lander of Apollo 11 and said, that's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind? Not only is it 50 years ago, it's 50 years ago later this week. So it's going to be a lot of stuff on TV, I'm sure. You know, it's going to be all over the place when we get to the actual date this coming weekend. But we thought we'd give you a little bit of a preview of the anniversary. And, you got to realize there's a generation or two now who has no memory of this. I mean, for them, it's like reading about the Spanish-American War or, you know, the Civil War in a history book, because they weren't around in July of 1969. When man first landed on the moon. So I hope you can be with us tomorrow. A special. It'll take up our entire It's Your Turn program tomorrow, starting at 12:30. Special from CBS on the 50th anniversary of man's first landing on the moon. That'll be tomorrow. Tomorrow, starting at 9:30. Back to talk with David Pietrucci about the Christmas truce during World War I. It's coming up on the It's Your Turn program here on WISR right after this.
The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location, downtown Butler, to talk about prearrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler.
Coming up on the It's Your Turn program here on WISR, my name is Dave Malarkey, and we're very pleased to be able to chat once again with historian David Pietrucci about a fascinating story, a heartwarming story. It took place a long time ago, over 100 years ago, during World War I. First of all, David Pietrucci, nice to have you with us again. Good to talk with you.
Good to be back.
We chatted with historian David Pietrucci before, in fact, most recently, on the release of his book on Theodore Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt. But we want to talk today about the Christmas truce in World War I. And I understand, David, that you just delivered a paper on this somewhere?
Yes, a talk at Siena College outside of Albany, New York. And it's an interesting topic. You've seen a lot of remembrances of it in the popular culture. The most recent is an actual opera which won a Pulitzer Prize. And for once, the Pulitzer Prize people got it right, because I saw this opera in production at the Glimmerglass Festival in upstate New York, and I can tell you, at the end of the first act, I was simply awash in tears. It's an incredibly moving story, but people have done things with it from commercials or little videos for Cadbury, or not Cadbury, but British Chocolates, or for Fox Sports News to play up soccer, or going way, way back to my youth, and I just heard it on the radio the other day, a very, shall we say, not exactly factual account, which is called Snoopy's Christmas.
Wow.
Remember that one?
Oh, yes.
Snoopy and the Red Baron?
Yes, yes.
Well, so that's sort of a takeoff on that. So it goes all the way from Snoopy to high opera, and commercials for chocolate, British chocolate companies, and everything in between, and a movie not too long ago called Joyeux Noël, which the opera is based very much on. So the story is very much alive in our memory, as it should be, because in the midst of World War I, which was just such a horrible conflict where tens of millions of people died, and then tens of millions of people more died, with the flu outbreak after that, the Spanish flu pandemic, it's to have something which shows humanity, which shows this a sense of mercy and of just goodness and decency, even for that brief moment, which was in 1914 December, then we want to look at that, and we want to have something to give us hope at this Christmas time.
Well, World War I, in large part, was fought by means of what we now call trench warfare, correct?
On the Western Front, and this is largely a Western Front story. There are smaller outbreaks with the Austro-Hungarians and the Russians of small truces like that. You see truces throughout history, actually. There's the Truce of God and the Peace of God in the Middle Ages. There's even little truces in the Napoleonic Wars and the Russo-Japanese War. And these are not Christmas truces, but I can, you know, doing this story, it jogged my memory. There used to be a Christmas truce every year in Vietnam.
Huh.
It might be 30 hours, it might be less than a day. I had it in my memory that a fellow who sat in a class with me in high school was killed during one of these truces. It appears to have been a false memory, but maybe he was killed during some other truce. But it's interesting that even with a communist system, the North Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, there was still some respect for Christmas then.
Speaking of trench warfare, maybe as a historian you can tell some of our
listeners... Trench warfare is important. It's important that you raise that, because these trenches are often very close to each other. The German and the French and the German and the British might be a few hundred yards or less away from each other. So these guys could hear each other. These guys sort of knew each other, you know, day after day after that. And then the fact that at this Christmas time, they were able to yell across to each other, sing across to each other, and really be so near, so proximate. That's a big part of making this work. What's amazing is it's not coming from above. It's spontaneous. It's from the men. And it is not one truce. it's unit by unit by unit for, you know, tens of miles, maybe hundreds of miles, largely British and German, by the way, not so much British and French. The French are pretty ticked off their country has been invaded and occupied, northern France occupied by the Germans, so they're less amenable to this.
Mm-hmm. I saw a movie about this some years ago, and they depicted the singing of Silent Night, which makes sense to me because
was that What a Lovely War?
I don't remember the film, but Silent Night was written. I mean, it comes from Germany. Stille Nacht, Stille Nacht.
Silent Night comes from Austria.
Yeah,
and that is, you know, they're different. Like I say, this is a series of individual truces all along the line. So in some ways, it may have started differently. But the most famous events, stories, are that the Germans start singing Stille Nacht, and the British recognize this as Silent Night, and they answer in English. And then you see, like, O Tannenbaum coming out, and the British might come out with some, oh, it's a long way to Tipperary, or Adeste Fidelis, which is, the Germans would be singing Adeste Fidelis in Latin, and the British would be coming back with, Oh Come All Ye Faithful.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the same hymns in different languages all up and down that line. Before that, what happens the night before is Christmas trees. The German High Command had shipped a whole bunch of Christmas trees, like maybe the kind you'd have in a small apartment, not big ones,
mm-hmm.
maybe the top of Christmas trees, to the front. And the German soldiers light these up. And the British are, of course, wondering what the hell is going on. Does this presage an attack? Is this some sort of a trick? And so it's the Christmas trees which even prefigure the singing as a start of this. And so it's all very much tied up with traditional Christmases.
Hmm. Now, you say that this was celebrated on the Western Front. The Eastern Front of World War One in Russia, but they celebrated Christmas at a different time of the year, right? Because they were still using the Julian calendar.
Yes, that was a problem. That was a problem. Earlier in the month, Pope Benedict the 15th called for a Christmas truce. And the Germans immediately agreed to it. The Germans really seem much more into this whole thing than anyone else. They immediately agree, and they say, we'll do it if you guys do it. And the British say, well, okay, but we will leave this up to the French, because it is a Frenchman, a French general, who is in overall command on the Western Front. And they say, no. And so nothing officially happens there. And as you say, on the Eastern Front, there's two Christmases. So which Christmas do you do? I suppose you could do both, but they do neither. And also, that, with the exception of a few big sieges, the situation is just so much more incredibly fluid on the Eastern Front. So you don't have this trench warfare thing. And also think about the time of the year. There's a lot of weather and time of the year involved in making this happen. Armies tend to come to a halt in winter, or at least did, preparing for, like, spring offensive. So things are, like, hunkering down. And also, these trenches are just miserable places. The water table in northern France, which is where the British lines were, tends to be very high. So as soon as you dig a trench, you know, I've seen figures in some areas, you go down a foot and it starts to flood. You go down 3.5 feet, it starts to flood. So these things are like people are walking around in these trenches getting trench foot in November, December, January 1914-15. More soldiers die from trench foot and gangrene and frostbite than they do from enemy fire. But when Christmas is coming up in 1914, the weather turns colder, which is actually good because the water freezes and you're no longer, you know, schlossing around in these things, and people can move about more. And it's also, the snow covers the ground, and it's, you know, as they say, beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
Hmm. We're chatting, listeners, with historian David Pietrusia. A quick break, but we have a couple more minutes to chat with him, so we'll be back here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these messages.
When planning a funeral, many times there's the question of cremation. Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler can answer your questions about cremation. Is cremation appropriate? Should there be a funeral service? How would your family feel about cremation? And of course, what's the cost? Keep in mind that even with cremation, it's a time to celebrate the meaningful life of your loved one. It's a precious time. Cremation has three advantages: simplicity, convenience, and it's local. Thompson Miller Cremation Program is right here in Butler at our newly created facility. We assure you that your loved one will never leave our care at any point in the process. So let's talk it over privately right here at Thompson Miller. Call us at 724-287-3706, 287-3706, or online at www.thompson-miller.com. Thompson Miller, at the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Thompson Miller, time-honored excellence.
You're listening to It's Your Turn here on WISR. I'm Dave Malarkey. David Pietrusia joins us by telephone, and we're talking about the Christmas truce during World War One. Happened in December of 1914. That's the right year, correct? That's early.
Yes.
That's actually pretty early, isn't it, in World War One?
Well, the war starts in August, so it's very early. People thought the war would be over by Christmas, and then they have settled in. The Germans make their big push on the Western Front, as they successfully did in 1870, as they successfully did in 1940, but it doesn't work in 1914, and everything just bogs down. The French fight back in that war. There's the Battle of the Marne, which saves Paris. The government had evacuated Paris. They had gone to Bordeaux. There were plans even to blow up the Eiffel Tower. I'm not quite sure what military value that would have had, but they were in a panic-stricken mode, but everything holds, and then it holds for 4 years with the static trench warfare.
Now, you mentioned that the two sides involved in the Christmas truce were the Germans and the British. Keep in mind, listeners, the United States was not even involved in World War One yet. In fact, we did not get involved in World War One until very late in the war.
1917, April, is when we get in, and then we really don't get involved in the fighting in any meaningful sense for another year. And then we take a bunch of casualties then, but nothing in comparison to what the Western allies or any of the combatants in Europe do.
David Pietrusia is a historian and writer. I am not, although I'm a bit of an amateur historian on World War II. Pretty widely read there. And I was just reading about the Battle of the Bulge, and this is about the time of the year that started, too, in Bastogne in 1944. And I was reminded in my reading that it was one of the coldest winters that anyone could remember in 1944, which impacted the American troops who were surrounded at Bastogne. Do we have any records about how cold it was during the Christmas truce of World War One, 1914, or did they even keep records?
Well, it got down to freezing because you had the snow. There was you can find this on YouTube. There's an individual sort of Christmas truce story, I think it was narrated by Robert Stack or something, about American soldiers who are lost in the Battle of the Bulge in World War Two, and go and wander into a farmhouse, which is occupied by the wife of a German army baker. He's not there, but she and her son is there, and these Americans come in, and they are given shelter, which is interesting, but then a bunch of Germans who are lost wander in, and she says there's going to be no shooting, there's going to be a truce at this Christmas, and the Germans actually help minister to a wounded American and make a stretcher for him. And so you even get a bit of a Christmas truce in that same area with Nazis. But in that 1914 truce, what you get is they come across the lines, they exchange presents because the folks in the home fronts in both countries had sent all kinds of things, cigarettes, chocolates, warm clothing, pipes, tobacco, everything to the men at the front. So they have a lot of things to exchange, and they exchange things even like those spiked helmets that the Germans had, or buttons from their uniforms. A lot of the Germans had been in Britain before World War One. We think of immigration as well. That's an American thing. 80,000 Germans had been living in Britain before 1914. Many of them as waiters and barbers, and they go back to Germany and fight. Adolf Hitler's half-brother had lived in Britain before, in Liverpool, I believe, before 1914. And so these guys, that's another thing which facilitates that truce, that the Germans, many of them speak English and are very familiar with Britain, and in some ways are homesick for it. They give to one British lieutenant notes to take back to a girlfriend. His German has left his girlfriend and his motorcycle in England at the beginning of the war. And another German brings over the papers from a dead British soldier to be returned, personal effects to be returned. Perhaps the most famous image of that truce is the soccer game, football as they call it, which is games break out along the front, maybe Saxons versus Scots, it becomes a sporting event. And they exchange booze. That's another thing which is exchanged. There's a story of a big keg of beer rolled down by the Germans that they had seized from a Belgian brewery, and they share that with the Brits. So it's really a case of amazing good fellowship. There is a very grisly aspect to this, and there had been truces like this before. One of the reasons why you have a truce is to bury the dead. When you rush the opposition and they die in no man's land, you can't get your comrades, and they are rotting dead bodies littering this no man's land. It's very horrible. So they are able to do that, and in many cases the British or German clergy will help bury the fellow from the other side. So it really is a remarkable story.
You mentioned this no man's land between the trenches, sometimes even just 100 or 200 yards apart. Was there a border? I mean, like, you know, barbed wire or something separating the two sides?
Yes, incredible amount of barbed wire. I saw a figure that 1 million miles of barbed wire was used on the Western Front. Now, of course, you know, there'd be one line of it, there'd be, you know, it would be blown up all the time. The front would be state moving in some way or another. But so there was barbed wire and barbed wire and barbed wire. That's one of the things which makes this a different sort of war. Barbed wire, massive, massive use of artillery, machine guns, later tanks, poison gas, flamethrowers. And, of course, airplanes coming in as well. All these new technologies come from that time period, that war.
Yes, we had never seen any of these weapons previously, certainly not airplanes. In fact, and I'm not particularly well-read on World War One, but weren't at least some of the artillery pieces still pulled by horse back in those days?
Oh, horses were really in great use in World War One. I also saw, not connected with this story, but I saw this recently, where most of the stuff we were shipping to Europe during the war was actually feed for horses in the army. Huh. And one of the things that Pershing, Black Jack Pershing, our commander of the American Expeditionary Force, was worried about American forces going in against the Germans was that we didn't have enough horses. So it's, yes, it's, you know, still not quite the modern age, And I've seen also a documentary made by the German army, not by Goebbels, but by the Wehrmacht in World War II, of talking about how they came and conquered the West, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, this whole lead up to Dunkirk. And you see a lot of horses. You see a lot of horses in action, not cavalry charges or anything like that, but hauling stuff, even in World War II.
General Pershing, World War One, and then later we named a tank.
Oh, yeah, a real cavalryman, too.
Yeah. Wasn't there a tank named after him in World War II?
That's right. That's right, because he was, I think, called General of the Army and the first fellow to bear that title since George Washington.
Hmm. So he would have been the Eisenhower of World War One then, right?
Kind yeah, of. And he had practiced for war, unlike Eisenhower. Eisenhower had never served in combat physically before that. He was not in World War One. Pershing serves on the western frontier. The reason he's called Blackjack Pershing is because he had commanded black troopers on our western frontier. He also served in pacifying the rebels in the Philippines when we take over that country in the wake of the Spanish-American War. And in the immediate lead up to World War One, or our involvement in it, he leads American troops, and one of his subordinates is George Patton, into Mexico to chase down Pancho Villa in the mountains and the deserts there after Villa invades New Mexico and shoots up a town called Columbus, New Mexico.
Wow, wow. We, of course, had photography and cameras in World War One. Are there any photographs of the Christmas truce, David?
You betcha, as Sarah Palin used to say, which was quite the a bit of a scandal. First off, cameras were banned, not by the official photographers, but were banned in the trenches by the men. They didn't want photographs or being taken and sent homeward and all this. You never know what could be sent back to destroy morale or to give away a position, etc., etc. This was not always adhered to. And in fact, there was a talk of having the truce extend to New Year's Day. And one of the fellows says that, oh, well, we wanted to do that to see how the photographs came out, okay? So there were these photographs, and they are sent back to Britain, and they are published in the New Year in British newspapers. And the photographs are quite remarkable because you see British and German soldiers standing together. In many cases, they've exchanged like uniform caps or helmets. So again, absolutely remarkable and stupefying if there was not so much documentation of it. And there really is, not just these photographs, not just official reports, but diaries and letters home for something which was so illicit. It's so wondrous in its unusualness, and it is remarkably well documented. So you can't say, you know, this never happened. This is some fairy story. This is some Walt Disney story. No, it's not. It really happened, and we have maybe more documentation of this than much of life on the Western Front.
Hmm. Well, as you say, it's remarkable. Wondrous, incredible, but greatly ironic, too. Here were these two sides who were, you know, shooting and killing each other, for goodness sakes. And the next thing you know, they're exchanging Christmas presents and beer and singing Christmas songs and during a temporary truce. What happened, by the way, after the truce ended? Because we're still early in World War One. There's a lot more fighting to come.
Well, they keep on fighting and fighting, and all those technological things and all those battles only ramp up in 1915. So the chance for goodwill on Earth and, you know, during Christmas 1915 is a lot less. It's gotten a lot bloodier, and people are less in a mood to forgive and forget, even for a few hours. The British High Command had warned early in December 1914 of the dangers of this, and the dangers of this to commanders in the field is, how do you start these guys up again? And it is difficult. It doesn't, in many cases, just doesn't stop on Christmas Day. And when they start it up again, they are very wary about shooting them, logically, emotionally, to go and shoot guys you've just talked with, 12 hours before.
Yeah.
So they may pretend to shoot at the other side, but they just shoot up in the air and waste ammunition. Or they give warnings that they are going to be firing again on the other side. They're very wary about killing their new chums. And they have a lot in common. You think of these reunions of Germans or Americans or Unions and Confederates 50 years afterwards, and there's a great bond between them because they've gone through stuff that, civilians or their home front people or their descendants have not gone through. So they have that bond. So even in the trenches of 1914, these guys have this bond of this horrible life that they have been undergoing now for a couple months.
I've been blessed to have the opportunity to visit Normandy and many of the battlefields of World War II, the Normandy Peninsula, Utah Beach, Omaha, and so on. There are, and I'm sure you know this, David, there are monuments and memorials all over Normandy about, such and such a battle was here, even small skirmishes like Lafayette outside of St. Mary Glees. There are all kind of monuments and memorials there. You'll be driving along a country road in France in Normandy, and all of a sudden there'll be a monument to, something that happened there. My question is, are there any monuments to the Christmas Truce from World War One?
There is a museum in that area, World War One Museum, but in the last few years, I think maybe at the 100th anniversary of this, a specific monument was enacted in northern France, and I think a member of the British royal family took part in that. So it is very well remembered in that part of the world.
The Christmas Truce,
and of course, it would be very much more remembered to the nationalities, to the nations that took part in it, and of course we didn't.
Yes.
So our memory of it is, sort of as a bystander.
Yeah, very good point, yeah. The Christmas Truce of 1914, during the early stages, really, of World War One. Maybe you've heard about it. Now you know the true story. Now you know what really happened during that Christmas Truce. Thanks to David Pietrusia, historian who recently delivered a paper on this topic, and very nice to chat with you today. I do want to remind listeners about your latest book, David, on Theodore Roosevelt. Can you talk about that for just a second here as we wrap up?
Yeah, that's called TR's Last War, Theodore Roosevelt, the Great War, i.e. World War One. So we're in that neighborhood again, and a journey of his journey of triumph and tragedy. And it tells his story about urging preparedness for that war, trying to get into that war, and what happens to his sons. And they all end up on that Western Front that we've been talking about.
David, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for being with us here today.
Thank you.
Sure. So long now. Don't forget, coming up on tomorrow's program, a special on the 50th anniversary of man's first landing on the moon. It took place this week. Yeah, this week. 50 years ago, summer of 1969. We'll have a special. It'll be the entire program tomorrow. It comes from our affiliate, CBS Radio, so I'll have a lot of interviews and stuff. Correspondent Peter King will be bringing all of you up to date on the, kind of revisiting the mission of Apollo 11. Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin went to the moon and back, along with Michael Collins, who was in the mothership. So that's tomorrow, 12:30. It'll be our entire It's Your Turn program on the Tuesday edition tomorrow. Pirate baseball tonight, 7:50 airtime from St. Louis. The Bucks hoping to have better luck in St. Louis than they did in Chicago. Airtime 7:50 for warm-up tonight. I'm Dave Mullarkey. That's our program for today. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for joining us for today's edition of It's Your Turn with Dave Malarkey here on WISR 680 AM. Today's broadcast is also archived for you online at WISR680.com. Tune in again next time for Dave Malarkey's It's Your Turn, weekdays from 12:30 to 1:30, right here on WISR 680.
The sunset.